From the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing, China, this is the China in the World podcast hosted by Paul Hanley.
Recently, I was happy to sit down with friend and foreign policy expert David Feierstein to discuss the different strategic perceptions of the United States and China with respect to regional and global security challenges. David spent nearly two decades in the Foreign Service from 1992 to 2010, including roles at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing and Moscow. Now the Perot Fellow and a Senior Vice President at the East-West Institute, he recently released a report entitled Alternative Strategic Perceptions in U.S.-China Relations. During our conversation, David and I discussed our experiences working in the U.S. government on China and the findings of his latest report, which exposes how differing perceptions between the U.S. and China inform and exacerbate policy and can fuel mistrust and strategic suspicion. I hope you enjoy our conversation, and I encourage you to head to the East-West Institute's website to read the full report entitled Alternative Strategic Perceptions in U.S.-China Relations, as well as leaving the China in the World podcast a rating and comment on iTunes. David, thank you very much for being with us today on the China in the World podcast. We're glad to have you joining us, and I'm very much looking forward to discussing with you your recent report, which you released as part of the East-West Institute, entitled Alternative Strategic Perceptions in U.S.-China Relations. As I mentioned to you earlier, I read the report, thought it was fascinating, and thought to myself, we should have written this report, because at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center, we bump into these different strategic perceptions on a daily basis. And you have put it into a report. I think it's an excellent report, very, very useful. Would encourage our listeners to pick it up and read it. But let me just ask at the beginning, you explore in the report many of the areas of contention in the U.S.-China relationship, ranging from specific topics like cybersecurity and THAAD deployment to broader ones like the U.S. rebalance, the pivot to Asia. Maybe just to open, if you could just share with our listeners, why did you decide to write the report and how... You know, why did you think it was important?
Well, Paul, thanks so much. It's an honor to be with you, and we're huge fans of what you do. And I think it's always great to be able to compare notes on these kinds of really important topics. And the alternative perceptions construct is something that we too bump into a lot in the work that we do at the East-West Institute on U.S.-China relations and on other issues that we work on as well. And it stems from the basic notion that one of the things we see is that there are differences of policy, but undergirding those differences of policy between the United States and China, there are often very different perceptions of, in some cases, the same set of facts, and in some cases, sets of facts that are not even agreed upon. And sometimes it's the perceptions that end up driving some of the biggest differences and policy responses. And we feel like it's difficult it's not as fruitful as it can be to talk about policy unless you have an understanding of the underlying strategic perceptual issues that undergird those policy choices. So whether it's with respect to the issue of North Korea and its pursuit of nuclear weapons, whether it's with respect to the issue of the South China Sea or Taiwan or East China Sea or the pivot or rebalancing to Asia, we've found again and again that two countries are looking in many cases at the same set of facts, but just truly not seeing them the same way. And what we hope to do in this report is to surface those differences so that the ensuing discussion about policy and about the relationship can take place on the basis of at least a mutual understanding of where those differences lie.
You know, you said it, your institution, East-West Institute, has been engaging with China on these issues for a long time. And I've been fortunate to be part of some of your activities. You write in the report, every major security policy difference between the U.S. and China has as its core
at its core, a divergence in strategic perceptions. Many of our bilateral tension points emerge from the different ways in which we see the world. How do we then, given this understanding, and your report actually lays out examples in a number of different areas, which is really quite useful, what are the mechanisms that we can use to ensure these perceptions don't lead to greater misunderstanding or to lead basically to the U.S. and China talking past each other?
Well, I think that phenomenon of talking past each other is very pronounced in the U.S.-China mm-hmm. relationship, and it's a good way to put it. I think the premise of our work is that when we look at, for example, from a U.S. perspective at why China does what it does, let's say, with respect to North Korea, unless you understand how they're perceiving the issue, it sometimes is hard to make sense of the policy choices that they make. And in order to be able to have a fruitful discussion about what the policy differences are, we just feel that it's important to really understand why they're viewing the matter the way they do. So with respect to North Korea, for example, the question of who is really to blame for the tensions mm-hmm. Gives rise to a very fundamental perceptual difference. We may not change the perception, but we need to be aware of it so that we can address the underlying concerns. And that's why we've tried to lay out the different kinds of perceptual lenses that are applied. And we've gone one step further than in the interest of trying to show a fair and kind of balanced way of looking at these issues by actually sourcing all of the characterizations that we make to primary sources that are authoritative from mm-hmm. the two countries mm-hmm. involved. Mm-hmm. So that when we say that China perceives a facet of the North Korean issue in this way or that way, we document that with an authoritative statement, mm-hmm. likewise for the United States. Yeah. By surfacing that, we think that we can at least increase the quality of the dialogue, and that creates the possibility of generating solutions.
Mm-hmm. You know, I tell this story often here in China. I think it highlights the strategic perceptions that you've laid out in the report. I often felt, and you also served in government and policy positions, that I would come to China with delegations, whether it was part of the Pentagon or other government agencies. Our delegation would sit across the table from our Chinese counterparts. Our principal would deliver the talking points that we put together. And, you know, maybe during the session, which lasted several hours, he might decide to pound his fist on the table and make some emphatic points. The Chinese side would sort of do something very similar. They'd use their talking points, pound their fist on the table. We would then leave. Our delegation would go to the hold room, and we would tell our principal, "You did a great job. I think the Chinese are really starting to get it."
Right.
And I could just imagine in my own head, the Chinese delegation in their hold room basically telling their principal the same thing. I think the Americans are finally starting to get it. How do we basically, what recommendations would you have for policymakers, given what you've laid out about these strategic perceptions in terms of engaging or changing the behavior in order to deal with the mutual strategic suspicion? What are the kind of solutions you might
prefer? Well, I think the main solution from the standpoint of the communications process, mm-hmm. which you're talking about, I think, very accurately, is that in my experience, I have found that I think representatives of our two nations, as we come together around the table to talk about issue A or issue B, are typically not as honest with each other in reality as we, I think, need to be on mm-hmm. matters of real importance and urgency. We lay out our talking points, the Chinese lay out their talking points, it's kind of set pieces, mm-hmm. and it's often very scripted, and we don't always say what we really think. And there may be a sense of decorum, a sense of diplomatic protocol, a sense that we don't want to cause discomfort or awkwardness, and we often don't say what's really on our mind. For example, and I'll just use one example to illustrate this point. And it's a point that I've made in a broader context about U.S.-China relations. And I think it's what I call an inconvenient truth in the relationship that is very often overlooked and avoided. But I think that undergirding the U.S.-China relationship is a fundamental mutual perception that is never discussed, namely that from a U.S. perspective, there is a primal anxiety about China that undergirds our thinking about China that is rooted in the fact that we, wittingly or unwittingly as a nation, see China as the only country in the world that can fundamentally change our way of life for the worse, primarily in an economic and trade sense. And that sense of existential competitive threat from China is not something that we give full play to in our discussions. On the other side of the ledger, if we're, in my judgment, if we're being honest, I think there is an underlying primal anxiety on the part of the Chinese toward the United States that is rooted in the fact that the United States, in my judgment, is viewed by the Chinese as the only country on the planet Earth that can fundamentally change the Chinese political and social system. And not that the U.S. intends to do that, seeks to do that, wants to do that, but that it does have a capability that could essentially end China's way of life the way it knows it. And those very profound anxieties about each other are not talked about, but rather, and I'll conclude with this point, we often say we have so many mutual interests, there's so many things we can do together, everything is fine, we just need to work together. But I think that by not recognizing and validating the understandable fears that we have toward each other, we miss an opportunity to elevate the level of our dialogue. And I think it's an absence of what might be called strategic honesty.
It's fascinating. And I think I would agree with you on the two examples that you gave for the United States and China. I think the anxiety Americans feel, my own sense, can be seen in the way we responded to the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank. You know, when I served in government, you know, we were pushing Robert Zoellick's famous phrase, China should be a responsible stakeholder, and encouraging China to do more to contribute to international public goods. They stepped forward with this Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, and we tried to get our best friends not to join it, which showed our insecurity. They ended up joining it, which showed our weakness, and we're isolated in the end.
That's right.
The Chinese anxiety about the United States trying to damage China's or change China's political system, I think can be seen in the accusations that the United States was behind the demonstrations in Hong Kong. And, you know, that the U.S. was the evil black hand trying to cause the Chinese Communist Party or the government in China problems, and ultimately to, you know, lead to an overthrow of the Chinese government. And I think it's fascinating because you, in those two examples, I think you can see the kind of dynamics you're talking about and the perspectives, both Chinese and American perspectives. Suggestion you've made is just being more honest, being more candid and frank about how we see these issues. In the case of the Hong Kong demonstrations, I know President Obama raised it with President Xi Jinping and said he has seen evidence, he's seen articles that talk about a black hand of the United States in those efforts, and if the Chinese leadership has proof, they should bring it to President Obama and he'll do something about it because, according to his view, that we're not involved in that. And so that seemed to have a positive impact. What other kind of things can the two governments do to deal with these two anxieties that each side has in going forward?
Well, I think, we certainly have a lot of contact between our governments. We've had this strategic and economic dialogue. We now have this comprehensive dialogue with these four substantial elements to it. I don't think any...
They just announced today, by the way, that next week they'll have the first diplomatic and security dialogue.
Indeed, and I think the other elements of that will play out this year in the run-up to probably a late 2017 Trump-Xi summit in Beijing, if I understand correctly. And I think, you know, there's a lot of contact, there's a lot of engagement. There has been for a long time. I think there probably aren't two governments in the world that engage each other more extensively than the United States and China. And yet, these fundamentally different perceptions exist. And I think the fundamental primal fears or concerns in the relationship are generally seen as too awkward or uncomfortable to raise. So, you know, I think oftentimes people say, and it's kind of a standard talking point on both sides, we just need more engagement. Yeah. And what I'm saying is I'm not convinced that we need more engagement. What I think is we need higher quality engagement, more honest engagement. I think at a broader level, or maybe a more fundamental level, public diplomacy, mm-hmm. In the sense of citizen to citizen and people to people exchanges, I think are very important. One suggestion I've made, friendly piece of unsolicited advice I've made to our Chinese friends is to perhaps it's time for China to emulate a best practice in terms of U.S. public diplomacy, and that's the International Visitor Leadership Program that we have that brings a large number of Chinese to the United States every year. When I worked at the U.S. Embassy here in Beijing about 20 years ago, I used to administer that project, and I saw the impact that some time in the United States had on people who had never been to the United
States.
Knocking
down preconceived notions.
Absolutely, and creating a more nuanced and accurate understanding about this country. And I think it might be time for China to have that type of engagement with the world, where they really bring people over and give people a chance to understand this country, as we would say it in the United States, warts and all. Yeah. So I think there are a number of different things at the broad level, but I would also acknowledge, I think that in the short term, this is a pretty difficult issue to get appreciable progress on. But we have to keep after it to increase the quality and the honesty of our dialogue in a very broad sense.
What can scholars and experts do in this regard? For example, I know that you have the distinction of being the first foreigner to write a regular column in a Chinese newspaper going back to 1995. And so, you know, Americans can write in Chinese publications, Chinese experts can write in U.S. publications. How can that help? And how should scholars and experts think about approaching it in that way, in terms of helping to knock down these different strategic perceptions that we have?
Well, I think I think that plays that kind of communication, that kind of publishing plays a very important role, because obviously in different ways the mass media in both countries and now the social media in both countries play a very substantial role in shaping perceptions. And I was really appreciative of the fact that as early as 1995, as you mentioned, I had the chance, even as a sitting U.S. diplomat in Beijing, to have a column in the Beijing Youth Daily. This is the Beijing Qianbao. And I had the opportunity to address two different kinds of issues. One was from an American perspective, looking at interesting things that were happening in China. And here I'm not speaking about policy, but about social and cultural issues and values and things like that. And what I was hoping to do was help Chinese understand how Americans look at some of these things, because sometimes you have to get outside yourself to see things more clearly. And there's a Chinese idiom about that, about Meng Shan. But by the same token, I also wanted to try to help Chinese readers understand the United States. And the basic model I tried to use, and here I wasn't mostly talking about foreign policy, but rather some of the social and cultural debates that were happening in the United States at that time, whether about physician-assisted suicide or gun control or even gay marriage. I remember on the occasion of the passage of the Defense of Marriage Act in 1996. And I was struck by the openness with which the editors and the leadership at Beijing Youth Daily allowed me to delve into those issues in a very open way. There I was talking about the United States, and there was the space to do that. Obviously, that space exists in the United States for Chinese to utilize to try to help Americans understand China. Yeah. And I think that kind of exchange makes a lot of sense and is very valuable. But the key is to be honest, to be authentic, to be real, and to not create a perception that it's mere, quote, propaganda or talking points, because readers on both sides see through that.
Pick up on that.
And it undermines the value and the effectiveness of that kind of communication.
Well, David, congratulations on the report, and congratulations on all the great work that the East-West Institute is doing. I know you've been out here all week for a number of meetings with Chinese scholars and experts and government officials. I hope those were fruitful, and we look forward to having you back in China. Maybe next time you visit the Carnegie Tsinghua Center and do another China in the World podcast.
Absolutely. Paul, thank you so much. We're huge fans of the center and really applaud the work that you do, and I look forward to staying in great touch.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
That's it for this edition of the Carnegie Tsinghua China in the World podcast. I encourage you to explore our site and see the work of all our scholars at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. Thank you for listening. Be sure to tune in next time.